Why are identity and political values, rather than geopolitics, the genuine causes of the Russian invasion of Ukraine? How can we locate the Russian invasion into the wider context of Ukrainian-Russian relations? You're listening to the Explain Ukraine podcast. Our guests today are Maria Popova and Oksana Shevel, authors of the book Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States, published last year. Maria Popova is a professor of political science at McGill University in Montreal, Canada. Oksana Shevel is an associate professor of political science at Tufts University in the United States and director of the Tufts International Relations Program. My name is Volodymyr Yermolenko. I'm a Ukrainian philosopher, chief editor of Ukraine World, and president of PEN Ukraine. Before we start, let me remind you that you can support us on patreon.com/ukraineworld. We provide exclusive content for our patrons. You can also support our volunteer trips to the front lines at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. Ukraine World is brought to you by Internews Ukraine, one of the largest Ukrainian media NGOs. Maria and Oksana, welcome to this podcast.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for joining, and we will discuss your book, Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. And this is a book which tries to look at the both deep history of Ukrainian-Russia relations and the recent history as well. First, let me ask you, Maria, how would you describe the main argument of this book? The main goal that you've written it for?
So the main goal when we started out writing this book was to try to explain why Russia invaded Ukraine and why Ukraine resisted this invasion so vigorously. And what we come up in the book is this argument about an escalatory cycle that developed between Ukraine's commitment to its independence and Russia's commitment to re-imperializing, sort of re-establishing control over Ukraine. And it's an escalatory cycle that we trace back to the end of the Soviet era and to a misalignment between the understanding of how and why the Soviet Union collapsed. And the idea was that Ukraine really saw the collapse of the Soviet Union as the civilized divorce, the end of the common statehood with Russia, whereas from the very start, Russia and Russian elites see the collapse of the Soviet Union as sort of the end of this particular version of common statehood, but maybe, you know, common statehood with Ukraine would somehow be reinvented, reestablished. And so it's an escalatory cycle because the more Russia pushed this idea of bringing back Ukraine back into the fold, the more Ukraine committed to its independent statehood, and the more Ukraine committed to independent statehood, the more Russia thought about what other ways it could use to bring Ukraine back. So this dynamic led to this growing, gradual, but very serious divergence between Russia and Ukraine in terms of identity, a distinctive identity in Ukraine versus an imperial identity in Russia, in regime type, increasing democratization in Ukraine, and sliding back into authoritarianism for Russia. And only as a last sort of divergence, this geopolitical divergence, which ends up sort of having more attention than it really deserves, because what we argue is that the drivers of this confrontation are actually the identity and the regime divergence to a greater extent than the geopolitical divergence that followed.
That's very interesting, and I would like to develop on it a little bit more. So, Oksana, let me ask you about this concept, which is quite often in your book, re-imperializing state in Russia. And I would say that Ukrainian example in the past decades was rather example of de-imperialization and decolonization. So we have divergent dynamics, temporal dynamics of re-imperializing versus de-imperializing, recolonizing versus decolonizing. Would you agree with this?
Yes, I think this is kind of, we spent quite a bit of time in our book talking about exactly how Ukraine comes to think of itself, the nation, the state, and how that's different from how Russia conceptualizes its own nation, which increasingly becomes more imperial and does include Ukraine in particular in this kind of imagined Russia. But what we also emphasize that this was really a process in both countries. So in other words, our argument is not that, say, Russians somehow like genetically imperialist or something like that. So we hopefully make a more sophisticated argument that for a variety of domestic political reasons in Russia in the 1990s, there were different identity conceptions. So there were some of them were very imperial, you know, from anything Russia kind of being equated with the Soviet people, right, as a Soviet nation, the same borders, notions of this Ruskoyazychne, right, Russian speakers, ethnic Russians, Slavic nation, but there was also an attempted identity project that would have defined Russia by the borders of the existing Russian state, the sort of civic Rossiyskaya nation. And for a variety of reasons that had to do with sort of domestic opposition Yeltsin was facing from the nationalists, from the communists, his own kind of lack of commitment really one way or the other to, he was not particularly animated by identity options. And then many people in his inner circle did have this pretty strongly imperialistic attitude towards Ukraine that, of course, we can date back to the Tsarist period. So this sort of consolidation of imperialism in Russia is gradual, it proceeds in fits and starts. There have been, you know, again, this hypothetical possibility that a different identity option could have been embraced by the ruling class, but that's not what happens. And of course, once Putin comes to power, we see even greater re-imperialization with this Ruski Mir construct. And really kind of conception of Ukraine, as Putin now says, is really part of it, is the same as Russia, right? Like Ukrainians and Russians are one people. And in Ukraine, as you said, it has been indeed de-imperialization because once Ukrainian state emerges as a political reality in 1991, the political class is interested to have also distinct Ukrainian nation and to have this because it increases legitimacy of the state. We live in the world of nation states, for better or for worse, in this notion that each state is a state of and for a particular nation, right? Like why is, you know, Canada is a separate state from, you know, US because there is such a thing as Canadian nation. So the same in Ukraine, this notion that, you know, Ukrainians and Russians are really one, some sort of Slavic nation and so forth, kind of run against the logic of statehood. And we see starting back, you know, in the early 1990s, Ukrainian political class committing to kind of legislating, for lack of a better word, certain policies that would underscore distinctiveness of the Ukrainian nation and therefore increase the legitimacy of the Ukrainian state. So we have things such as, for example, single citizenship. Right? Ukraine opposed dual citizenship with Russia very strongly, something Russia actually wanted to accomplish because, again, it served to blur the boundaries between the two nations. But having distinct citizenship, a political nation, served the purposes of strengthening legitimacy of the state. The same we can say about state language, right? Ukrainian is the only state language, was not about forcing everybody to speak Ukrainian, but was about, again, signaling that here is distinct state, distinct nation, it has its own language. The same for history. We go in the book over how Ukrainians were shifting narration and teaching of history in Ukraine, kind of emphasizing again Ukraine's distinct historical past as opposed to it being always historically tied to Russia. So all of these processes we discuss in the book. So yes, to your question, we agree with, you know, what you said does capture what our book is trying to accomplish when we talk about identity.
Thank you, Oksana. Let me ask Maria right now, also following this topic. In one of your sentences, you call Russian nation as a supranational civilization. Obviously, this is a self-identification of the Russian nationalism in the last decades. In this word, civilization obviously refers to a very popular idea in Russia, which is connected to the neo-Eurasianist, but also with even with current Russian ideology, I think this concept of state civilization is even inscribed into Russian official documents. So do you think that Russia is still not a nation state because it tries to define itself as a much wider than a nation?
Yeah, I think maybe Oksana is best to take this question.
I guess I did more like of the identity because this has been my line of work and Maria's is a lot of expertise on the regime part. So for the civilization part, what I would say, right, in a way, we can say that Russia is confused to this day what exactly Russia is. And this is why, you know, this claim to Ukraine is so central, because Russia didn't have to define itself as this, supranation. I mean, you can call it civilization, but I think it is really the core of this identity is that the true nation, quote unquote, right, the objective nation, extends past the borders of the existing Russian state and includes Ukraine. And then you have to have a narrative sort of what makes it a nation, right? Like we have common Orthodox faith, right? That's one of the sort of features as Putin defines it, it has become increasingly prominent in the civilizational conception. We stand for traditional values. Like as you're saying, it is all constructed, but this is the image that Russia projects. So in that sense, we can say, yes, Russia is not a nation state in the modern sense, and certainly not kind of nation state at peace with itself, because it is trying to push past its existing borders. But hypothetically speaking, Russia could narrate its national history differently, so that we could imagine hypothetical situation, and that's something that fails in the 1990s under Yeltsin, but hypothetically, you know, different elite could come to power that could be committed, you know, abandon its sort of imperial aspirations. And then, you know, nation building is always a process. It's a constructivist process. Could try to narrate Russian nation as a nation state. It would be very difficult, but it's not impossible. So again, because you're saying in the book that certain choices were made under the constraints that existed at the time, where this nation state idea, Russia, Российская nation, in the borders of the existing Russian state was abandoned in favor of this kind of civilizational / imperial notion. And that's where we are now. But it is not sort of set in stone, theoretically speaking, and potentially in some years down the road, we may or we may not see a different way of narrating the Russian nation.
Yes, I definitely agree with you that we cannot say that, it's, as you say, it's genetically inscribed into the Russian nation that it is an empire. Well, the Russian nation, the Russian statehood, that it is an empire. The problem is that I don't really see much of the theory of the Russian nation and theory of Russian democracy, you know, on what is the history of Russian liberalism? I mean, this is very, very little. But of course, we should keep the future open. Maria, let me address you the question of regime then. I don't know who was writing the chapters about the 90s. I think it's a very important chapters. And I'm particularly very interested in the way how you describe this crisis between president and parliaments in Russia and in Ukraine, meaning Yeltsin putting tanks and shelling at Russian state Duma and Duma trying to impeach the president and really confrontational. So can we say that this authoritarian choice was made by the Russian politics and Russian society already in 1993-94, while in Ukraine there was an attempt to make this choice, and even Kuchma had this authoritarian, you know, trends, and therefore otherwise we cannot understand what happened in 10 years after that with the Orange Revolution. But still, Ukrainians chose this democracy path much more willingly, and then those people who tried to, you know, to destroy it, meaning late Kuchma, first Yanukovych, second Yanukovych, were actually defeated by the revolutions. What would you say?
Yeah, indeed. I think what we the point that we make is that Russian democracy died before Putin even came to power. That indeed There was a very short opening for democratization in Russia that really ends with the shelling of parliament in 93. And there is no, I mean, it's a very common thing to just simply point out that in Ukraine, most incumbent presidents lose re-election, whereas in Russia, no one has lost an election. No incumbent has lost an election. So that's kind of the surface of it. But the deeper divergence, indeed, we argue, happens even before it's captured by a lot of the indices that in the 90s, they see Russia and Ukraine as fairly similar in a lot of ways, as, you know, having the same political problems. But it does look, when we examine this in hindsight, it does become evident that in Ukraine, all of these crises and confrontations ended up being resolved in through compromise of some sort, whereas in Russia, basically, Yeltsin imposed himself and imposed the solution unilaterally without any compromise. And it may have something to do with the fact that the proportion of sort of the Democrats in Russia was just smaller. That basically we have the Gaidar, sort of the liberal reformers that were throughout really a small minority, you know, maybe at best about 20%. They never could win a parliamentary victory, even though they were sort of in a position of power, so to speak, because Yeltsin was promoting them. They never did broaden their appeal to the electorate. The electorate was mostly supporting sort of revisionist reactionary forces rather than or following Yeltsin as the leader. But there is a small sort of section of the political spectrum that was committed to democracy, whereas that segment in Ukraine through the grand bargain sort of seems to be a bigger part and of the of political competition, and that maybe is what explains why Ukrainian politics before it became more democratic after after the Orange Revolution was still highly competitive, and throughout has been highly competitive. So that's a major difference that starts really from the very beginning of the two independent states. I mean, what we in the Russian example, what we try to reason through some counterfactuals is whether some sort of bigger room for political competition could have been sustained for longer. It didn't, you know, let's say if Yeltsin had chosen a different successor, you know, maybe things may have remained a bit more competitive longer, but it's really not, first of all, that didn't happen, but also it's hard to see sort of what a critical juncture could have really put Russia on a very clear democratic path. We don't really see that that missed opportunity. I mean, from the very start, it's a question of whether there will be some competition or not, rather than whether democracy has a good chance of consolidating.
That's very interesting what you say about Yeltsin, because I mean, indeed, many people in the West perceive him as a Democrat, but if you look at him closer, he would rather be this image of a good Tsar for the Russians. And I think this is one of the one of the intrigues of the Russian politics is not the solution between different ways of general will or different you know, fractions of society. It's rather a choice between different tsars, whether it's a good tsar or a bad tsar. So at a certain moment, Yeltsin appeared to be for the Russians a good tsar, and therefore they were okay with this. But Maria, let me stay with you and ask a question about oligarchs, because oligarchs is obviously a very hot topic. Like, everybody asks a question about oligarchs. But what you described in Ukraine, this competitiveness, competition, political competition, it also has something to do with the wealthy people who support those parties, at least support it in the past. And I don't know, my point is that in Russia there is no oligarchs at all. So because all those wealthy people, their property is not guaranteed. And everything depends on this vertical system of power. And therefore Putin was so quick in, you know, fighting these oligarchs because he had all the means of this judiciary and law enforcement system. Would you agree with this idea that one of the elements of the difference is that, yeah, in Ukraine, oligarchs appear to be stronger than in Russia, and probably they ensured, despite of their, you know, bad influence on politics, but the very fact that there were many of them ensured a certain safeguard against tyranny?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it is definitely... it's definitely one of the strongest misconceptions of the Yeltsin era that oligarchs controlled politics and Yeltsin was a figurehead. But really, it seems, given how easily and quickly Putin put the oligarchs in their place, so to speak, how quickly he forced some of them into exile and made the others pledge allegiance, it really shows that they were, that they have their wealth at the full mercy of the state. It's sort of a situation of, you know, what God gives, God can take away, right? So I think it is true that they're oligarchs in the sense that they have huge assets. They're very wealthy people, but not in the sense that they're ruling. And whereas in Ukraine, indeed, the diversification sort of the oligarchic class, the fact that they were not only many of them, but some of them being sort of, they're distributed through the political spectrum, right? Poroshenko, very different from Medvedchuk in their political orientations. That really was a recipe for both constant competition, but also forcing them to occasionally reach compromises in order to coexist, negotiate. I mean, from the very start, this is sort of one of the bases of deliberation, basically, that the oligarchs were either checking each other or cooperating in order to divide the spoil, so to speak. But that is a very different system from the Russian one, where indeed sort of a tsar at the top distributes the spoils and can absolutely make or create an oligarch unilaterally and without much constraint by the oligarchic class. And indeed, for example, Stan Marcus, who's written a book about also comparing Russia and Ukraine in terms of the oligarchic class, he wrote an article early in the war when the full-scale invasion started in 22, which was entitled "Who the Oligarchs Are and Why in Russia and Why They're Not Going to Stop This War," basically because they don't have the power to do it.
Right. This is exactly what I think, and this echoes a very old analysis, which was done in the 19th century by Marquis de Custine when he was describing Russia in mid-19th century, when he was actually saying that all the Russian aristocrats are just slaves with regard to the Tsar. Oksana, let me ask you a question, about this war. And obviously, I think one of the arguments of your book is you show how these questions of identity, questions of language, questions of perception of the polity that you are building are actually at the origins of the Russian invasion, both in 2014 and the full-scale invasion in 2022. And if we look at the way how Putin presents the reasons of this war, the causes of this war, both in his notorious article about Russians and Ukrainians and in his recent interview to Carlson, Tucker Carlson, we see that. How do you see this link?
Yes, that's a very important question. And I think there are a lot of misperceptions, including in Putin's own characterization, some of the things, you know, all of this talk about persecution of Russian speakers and some sort of, you know, Nazi government and Maidan coup, like all of these things that sort of seem like proximate causes. And it was that problem. But really, the broader problem, again, goes back to identity, because Russia wanted to reimperialize Ukraine. So the goal, overall goal, is to control, even if Ukraine has nominal sovereignty, some sort of, you know, government that is technically like formally independent, but it does not do anything Russia doesn't want it to do in all manners of policy, not just foreign alliances, but all manners of domestic politics, identity politics, you know, even like economic reform policy, all of this. And how do you accomplish this, right? So that was really what Russia has been trying to do, kind of, you know, with different maybe commitments and level of vigor during Yeltsin and then during Putin. And, you know, as Putin consolidated his power in Russia and this imperial identity grows, there is stronger commitment to accomplishing this. Like, how do you do this? So in the book, we go over several sort of, things, possibilities when maybe divergence could have been avoided and Ukraine could have been brought under Russian control without full-scale invasion. One hypothetical possibility, let's say if Euromaidan ended with a different outcome, had Yanukovych prevailed, and then he would have not only consolidated more authoritarian regime, he could have then sort of delivered Ukraine to Putin, for lack of a better word, on identity matters as well. I mean, he's been doing the things such as changing, you know, language regulation, you know, this greater status for Russian, recasting identity politics, different interpretations of Holodomor, of shared history, and all of this. But then, of course, Yanukovych is out, right? And then kind of again, the question becomes, what does Putin do about it? And Putin decides to gamble on this so-called federalization of Ukraine by way of fostering and manipulating and amplifying this dissatisfaction with the outcome of Euromaidan in southeastern Ukraine. So we talk in the book quite a bit about events in Donbass and the Minsk process. But our argument is that sort of paradoxical that the war in Donbass was not really about Donbass. The conflict in Donbass was not really about Donbass, but it was again about Russia trying to control the entirety of Ukraine. And the mechanism or the, you know, attempted mechanism was through the so-called special status in the Minsk peace agreement. Because if the special status was put in the Ukrainian constitution, and the special status was very vague in the agreement itself, and it was supposed to be specified, quote unquote, in consultation with these leaders of these proxy entities that Russia was fostering. The goal was to basically have these entities have veto power over central Ukrainian government. And had this been accomplished, then again, we can sort of say Ukraine would have been vassalized and Russian reimperialization goal could have been achieved without the need for full-scale invasion. Because if Ukrainian constitution was changed the way Putin wanted, if these Donbass proxies could veto indeed Ukrainian government policies in all manners, not just foreign alliances, but, you know, things domestically as well, then again, kind of, there is no need to invade. But that also fails because even Zelensky, who comes with a promise, to bring peace, and Ukrainian society does want peaceful negotiation, like peaceful resolution, but they don't want that special status because, again, there is growing understanding in Zelensky government and also in the elite that it is really sort of a way to curtail Ukrainian sovereignty. So so that's where we're going, you know, in our argument in the book. So we emphasize this, that this goal the goals of the invasion was not control of any particular chunk of Ukrainian territory. It was not about Novorossiya or Donbas republics or any sort of other specific piece of territory. It was really about controlling central Ukrainian government. And we can say even now, because, you know, when Putin says in an interview to Tucker Carlson that he hasn't achieved the goals of special military operation, yes, they're now occupying 20% of Ukrainian territory. But Ukrainian government in Kyiv is not controlled by Russia, right? It is still, as Putin calls it, like, you know, Nazi junta and what have you. And this is really just double speak to say that you want to have a puppet regime in Ukraine. That's what it's all about, right? And until and unless that happens, the goals of the special military operation are not achieved. So again, you know, this notion that some in the West are ready to embrace, that if, you know, Ukraine only gave up whatever territory that Russia now occupied, like that could be a way to end conflict for good. We really don't think, though, because the whole pattern, you know, going back to the 90s, really what Russia's objectives are in Ukraine is control of the entire Ukrainian state and not just of some sliver of territory.
Absolutely. I agree with you totally, because I think you also use this concept of Trojan horse, these so-called republics as put into the body of the Ukrainian state, into the body politic of Ukrainian state, and actually used as a Trojan horse to control Ukraine from within. And obviously all these illusions about territories, territorial gains that Russia can stop while it conquers certain territories, these are just illusions by people who do not understand the depth of history that you describe. Maria, let me ask you about the Ukraine's Western orientation, about which you're also writing about in this book. And you put forward a very interesting argument, which also is very close to what I see, how I see things. You say that, look, Russia was saying about this NATO expansion as the reason why it attacked Ukraine, but you point out that basically, Ukraine did not receive any insurances by NATO or the EU that it will become an EU member. Even the EU candidate status is all only a response to the Russian invasion. And if there were no invasion, well, there is a big question whether this EU candidate membership status would appear. So in a sense, the West didn't really want Ukraine to be integrated. It is rather the subjectivity of Ukrainians, the agency of Ukrainians, who stressed from the 90s through the 2000s, 2010s, that we want to be NATO, we want to be in the EU, that actually put at least the EU in a position that it should try to open its doors. Would you agree with this?
Absolutely. For all the talk about how the West was humiliating Russia after the end of the Cold War, what this misses is that, in fact, when it comes to Russia-Ukraine relations, the West was very much humiliating Ukraine. The West was constantly deferring to Russia's ambitions to control its former Soviet republics, and the West was constantly sort of considering how to make sure that Russia is not antagonized, and was sacrificing Ukrainian aspirations to the altar of understanding Russia's legitimate interests in the neighborhood. So, for example, when Yushchenko comes to power in 2005, in his inauguration speech, he talks about Ukraine being a European country, and he imagines that if his administration institutes all of these reforms very quickly, by the end of his term, maybe Ukraine will be making it into the EU. And immediately there is cold water poured on all of his ambitions and all of his enthusiasm, because basically it is communicated through European policy that Ukraine will not be moving very quickly because there is a need to think about what Russia, how Russia would react to this. And later on, we know, of course, that that Bucharest Memorandum has this completely open-ended, very vague promise to Ukraine to be a member someday. But the reason this is so is because there is within NATO, very much reluctance by France and Germany at that point, reluctance to make any promises to Ukraine. The declaration is really George Bush's kind of idea, and he is on his way out. He's already a lame duck president. He's finishing his term. We can't even say that he speaks necessarily for a U.S. position rather than his own idea of how things are going to go. So then when Russia first invades Ukraine and grabs Crimea, again, the West is telling Ukraine to be careful, not to antagonize further, not to fight over Crimea because Russia is so powerful. So really, it's the Western integration story for Ukraine is one of Ukraine constantly pushing and advocating for itself rather than the Russian narrative of the West luring Ukraine, which really has no basis for it. If anything, the West was constantly resisting Ukraine's ambitions and requests.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Oksana, maybe my last question, and the question will be, do you think that Russia is afraid of Ukraine? Not really in the military terms, but in terms of the questions of identity or the questions of values. Do you think it is afraid that if Ukraine succeeds, then all these values that Russia actually hates, it doesn't really know how to work with them, the values of horizontal relations, the values of democracy, the values of pluralism, that Russia is afraid that they will penetrate Russian territory and then, of course, create a big challenge for the authoritarian regime?
Yes, that's an important question. And this argument certainly has been made that basically a precedent of Ukrainian democratic success is a very dangerous for Putin's authoritarian regime model because, you know, again, if Ukrainians are really just like Russians or Russians, and if they can succeed, right, in having functioning democracy, market economy, less corruption, so forth, then, you know, Russian people would say, well, why not us? And that would sort of threaten Putin's authoritarian model. The way we think about it through our book, that first of all, yes, there is something to this argument for sure. But this was probably a more compelling argument to be made in, say, mid-2000s, like at the time of the Orange Revolution, right, than it is now. Why that is the case? Because when Ukrainian Orange Revolution succeeds and, following the rigged elections, there are these popular protests that bring to power the challenger, Yushchenko. That, you know, in Russia, it is clearly perceived as a very dangerous precedent. This is when we see Putin kind of like protest-proofing, there is all sorts of legislation to limit repetition of this scenario in Russia. There are these like fake news groups created, all of this, right? So there is certainly, at that time, you know, Putin's authoritarian regime is less consolidated than, you know, it would become subsequently. But I think this notion that sort of now this is what is, that's Putin's fear, you know, we think it's somewhat less convincing given how strongly entrenched and consolidated Putin's authoritarian regime is. So sort of the idea that Russian people now would like look at Ukrainian, you know, say successful, you know, be it protest activity or civil society pressuring, the leads to reform the judiciary, any of these things, and they would like, oh, you know, now we are going to do this too. That seems kind of less likely, again, given how strongly entrenched Putin regime is. So your short answer to your question is like, yes, there is something to this argument, but we would probably say maybe this argument is not equally persuasive for all time periods. But if we go back to the identity thing, I think, you know, Ukraine really succeeding as a functioning, you know, sovereign nation state integrated in the Western institutions is threatening to Russia because they have to sort of then redefine Russia somehow else, right? Like if you have now this notion that, you know, we are really one people who were artificially separated through all of these Western meddling and nationalists and so forth, and we are trying to kind of right the wrong and bring everybody together to be one big happy family. If that fails, right, then Russia has to redefine itself somehow else, because otherwise, you know, what are you doing? Like, you have this nation and state that as you imagine yourself, but you can't have it. So are you like permanently humiliated? So I think in that sense, that danger or, you know, problem remains. But specifically on the democracy, we would say it's a more compelling argument in 2004 than it is now.
Yeah, maybe I'll just add here one sort of piece of suggestive evidence for why this is not the fear that's driving things now. Think about the fact that the Russian opposition is not an admirer of Ukrainian democracy, right? Even the Russian opposition is not saying, wow, Ukraine is a really great model for us. They, in fact, tend to scoff at Ukrainian democracy and tend to claim that, you know, it's just some clan competition, but nothing to be proud of. So I think it kind of illustrates that Putin really has nothing to worry about right now in terms of large swaths of the Russian population being inspired by Ukrainian democracy. This just doesn't seem to be the case.
So given this assessment of yours, what do you think are the real reasons of this war? And based upon this assessment of the reasons and causes of this war, where will Putin stop?
I mean, the real reasons, I think, for the full-scale invasion is sort of this continued divergence that we note. Because in the years between 2014 and 2022, Ukraine became more and more different from Russia and was sort of slipping. The possibilities for Russia to impose its control over Ukraine were decreasing as Ukraine was instituting reforms that weakened the pro-Russian oligarchs, you know, the media ban attack on Medvedchuk, the fact that Minsk was failing, sort of the different avenues of Russian possibilities for Russian control were closing. So we think that sent Putin a message that, you know, now is the time to actually fully invade Ukraine and end this charade of some negotiations. They're not working, so let's go all out for it. And as a message of where this ends, I mean, I think Putin has been very clear. He is not prepared to end this before he has achieved, as Oksana already mentioned, denazification of Ukraine, meaning imposing a puppet regime of some sort on Ukraine, getting rid of its current government and reestablishing control. This is the ultimate goal.
Oksana, you wanted to add?
Yeah, no, I fully agree with this. The only thing that I would add, that Putin sort of stops where he is stopped. So I think this is this notion that, you know, Ukraine... that Putin cannot be stopped. The evidence just doesn't support it. Whenever Putin was faced with a show of strength, they retreated, right? Like, they were kicked out of Kharkiv, they were kicked out of Kherson, despite the fact that, you know, Kherson was formally integrated according to the Russian law in its, you know, constitution. I mean, in its by changing the constitution. So technically, it was like attack on sovereign Russian territory, right? And it wasn't followed by any kind of, you know, nuclear response or any of these scenarios that some in the West fear that Putin would do if he's pushed. So you know, the notion that, as Maria said, that we do believe, and we say it in the book, that the goal is to control of entire Ukraine. It is not some sort of, you know, grab of certain piece of territory. And he will try to push for that, you know, as long as he can. He staged his whole legitimacy on this. I think this is his image of sort of what Russia ought to be. I mean, he seems to be really obsessed about history for reasons that we may never know fully, or at least not until, you know, historians dig into the archives. But he will stop where he is stopped. So that's why, you know, the continued aid to Ukraine is so important. And then when Putin does face with a show of strength, he does retreat, and we have plenty evidence of that from this war since February 22.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point that he stops where he stopped. And by the way, not necessarily in Ukraine only, because if we remember 2021 and these ultimatums that Russia has put forward to the NATO, we see that the appetites are much wider than even Ukraine. Maria and Oksana, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you.
I just remind that we have talked with Maria Popova and Oksana Shevel about the fresh book that they have published, Russia and Ukraine, Entangled Histories, Diverging States. This was a podcast explaining Ukraine by Ukraine World, a website in English about Ukraine. My name is Volodymyr Yermolenko. I'm a Ukrainian philosopher and journalist, chief editor of Ukraine World. Ukraine World is brought to you by Internews Ukraine, one of the largest Ukrainian media NGOs. You can support our work at patreon.com/ukraineworld. You can also support our volunteer trips to the front lines at PayPal, ukraine.resisting@gmail.com. You can find these links in the description of this episode. Stay with us and stand with Ukraine.